WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
And welcome to WrestleSpective. I am Jason Mann, and my guest once again is Will Pruitt of ProWrestling.net. Will, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I've watched way too much Kurt Angle things today. Too many Kurt Angle things.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of things to talk about because this is Kurt Angle's debut match. Well, I guess it's not actually his debut match. It's his pay-per-view debut match in TNA. Genesis 2006, the undefeated Samoa Joe taking on Kurt Angle. I guess also undefeated in TNA since he won his first match against Abyss on Impact. So there you go.
Yeah, I think with Samoa Joe, we're supposed to say unbeaten because technically he was defeated in an Ultimate X match. And that's how they took the X Division title off of him while moving him up into the main event. But yeah, the unbeaten Samoa Joe and Kurt Angle, it was a dream match. They billed it as one. It really felt like a dream match when it happened.
The atmosphere really is quite vivid and animated, and the crowd clearly treats this as a huge deal. The announcing in TNA, which to me often overhypes things to incredible degrees, actually felt pretty much like it was on point here as far as how crazy they were going and so on and so forth. So it really did seem like a huge deal, and it was certainly felt like a moment where TNA may have been on the cusp of something, of getting bigger and becoming kind of a legitimate number two or closer to WWE in perception. And that really didn't happen to the degree that it kind of seemed like it could have at this point.
Yeah, and TNA, there were a lot of things happening in that company right around when Kurt Angle came in. I mean, you had the Angle announcement, which when we look back on it is the biggest thing. This is also when they moved to having a primetime slot on Spike TV. I believe they still had a one-hour show, but it was Thursday, they moved to Thursday nights at 9 with a two-hour special that Kurt Angle's first match with Abyss was actually at the end of.
Right.
And right around this time was, right around Kurt Angle's debut slash this pay-per-view was the first major pay-per-view with Vince Russo in charge of the company and getting to execute his storylines.
Right, yeah, because they brought him back after he was involved with TNA in the early Nashville years, like the 2003. I don't know exactly when he left, but he had a decent length absence and then came back and creatively, I think that was a huge negative. I'm not saying Russo is completely worthless, but I do think that like Russo has limited ideas and an outdated mindset of what wrestling, at least is enjoyable for me. And it seems like he really, other than that, few years of WWE success, was never able to replicate that.
I think it showed even on this. This Genesis card, this was 1 month after Bound for Glory, their biggest show of the year, that had Sting leave that show with the TNA title and the triumphant babyface moment. And earlier on this card, Sting lost the NWA heavyweight title via disqualification.
Right. Yeah.
And, it took him a month, then he was back to pulling out some old Vinnie Roo tricks, and it's... he did it right up until recently, and we're recording this in 2012 in June, and TNA has had a recent upkick story-wise where things just make sense all of a sudden.
Yeah, and who knows how successful it will be, but it does seem like it's a show that more people are enjoying, at least more, I guess, more wrestling fans, more people who are really passionate about wrestling are following. And, you know, obviously you can't just please them, but, you know, it's nice to have a show that does please the people who really care about wrestling the most. So, you know, that's got to at least be good. But let's start from the beginning here with Kurt Angle in 2006 in WWE. Sorta seems kind of creatively a little bit lost after that WrestleMania. Is involved in the world title picture there at that WrestleMania. Sorta gets shuffled around, ends up in ECW, sort of centered, because that's when WWE created ECW as a third brand and got the show on the Sci-Fi Network and was seemingly going to kind of take off with that, and Angle being one of the big stars of that. And then suddenly he sort of disappears early in, I believe in September of, or late in August, early September of 06. And turns out that he has a lot of real life issues that was keeping WWE from wanting to use him.
Well, and even before that, he was moved to ECW when they relaunched the brand and branded as kind of the wrestling machine. That's when he started wrestling with the mouthpiece and everything. And the whole idea was Kurt Angle's intense now. Even before that, earlier in the summer, he was suspended for 30 days in a wellness policy suspension. And this is before they went super public with those. So he was just kind of written off of TV for 30 days.
Right.
It was before the wellness policy really started to have teeth after the Benoit situation made everyone aware that it was a farce before. And then he was released on August 25th, 2006. And I remember that day, you know, just going to WWE.com for funsies. And you look, first thing you see on the front page is Kurt Angle released, and they have an interview with him there and all of that. And that was pretty, that was shocking, really, that he, that he was let go, because at the time, I mean, they were building ECW around him. He was a main event player no matter what brand he was on for, you know, since 1999 or the year 2000.
Yeah, definitely. Right. I mean, he was obviously, you know, one of their top three or four stars of that period. And as far as guys who were consistently on the shows, you know, through those years. And yeah, I remember it was a huge deal. It was a shock. And it didn't really make much sense because, you know, Angle, you know, he had a guaranteed contract. I've seen figures of $1 million per year. So it just seems odd that he would just give that up when he didn't have to, just to, because they would have given him time off to deal with, you know, at first it was talked about injuries were kind of the specific reason. Later we learn a lot about, you know, drug issues that he has.
Yeah, the original thing they were saying is he has nagging injuries, and a lot of the interview that he did originally with WWE.com talked about, hey, he's had neck injuries since the Olympics. You know, he always talks about how he won the gold medal with a broken neck. Well,
right.
Broken necks don't magically heal, and you know, so they attributed it to him mentally breaking down and him getting injured. And even in that interview on the website, Vince McMahon said, hey, Kurt, we want to give you this time. When you're healthy, come back. My door is always open. There's a contract waiting. All you need to do is sign.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously did not happen because we're talking about this match.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it seems like their relationship disintegrated pretty quickly. Mentions of a heated and controversial meeting with WWE officials, and WWE even had a message sent out that said that they described that meeting that way and then labeled Angle as an emotional wreck when he left the building. So, you know, obviously that relationship sort of disintegrated, and suddenly about a month later, he's a huge surprise for TNA, a reveal at No Surrender, September 24th, 2006. So that TNA, that Kurt Angle signed a TNA contract. And it's so odd to me that WWE let him out of the contract without having some sort of I guess if you release somebody from a contract, maybe you that having a provision that he can't go to TNA, or at least having that, like, you know, having a clause that he, you know, 90-day clause or whatever. It seems so weird on their end that they would have let that happen.
Yeah, you mentioned that meeting, and it's funny. Kurt Angle, in the time between when he signed with TNA to when he kind of debuted for them, he did a lot of conference calls and different media interviews with Bubba the Love Sponge and others. And God, Bubba the Love Sponge, why are you so intersected with wrestling history?
Yeah,
it's disappointing, really. But he said in a lot of them, oh, well, I acted like I was crazy, or I acted unstable in that meeting, so they would give me my release. And,
right,
you know, WWE said, homie was crazy in that meeting. He seemed pilled out of his mind. And Kurt's going, no, that was an act. And there's a lot of situations with Kurt during this time. You know, he mentions once, you know, WWE was saying, hey, he's addicted to painkillers right now. Kurt says, well, in the last 18 months, he haven't taken painkillers in 3 years. And then he specifies that 3 years means 18 months. And that before then, he was taking 65 to 70 pills a day, and he quit cold turkey. And Kurt said that Vince McMahon, or that he wanted to go to rehab when he was taking 65 to 75 pills a day. And Vince McMahon said, you're an Olympic gold medalist. You can rehab on the road. We need you. And I'm not going to say whether that did or did not happen, because it doesn't sound that crazy. But, you know, you look at all of this, and you look at one of the reasons that Angle, well, that they say that Angle demanded his release from the company was that WWE wouldn't give him, or that WWE was asking him to go to rehab. And they said that and he said no. So that's a little more. And it does seem odd that he would get out of his contract. You look at Brock Lesnar when he was in a similar situation and just wanted to go and leave WWE. He signed a non-compete clause that ended up making it so he couldn't compete in UFC or even in Japan. He wasn't supposed to wrestle and all of that. And eventually he got out of that non-compete clause, but WWE kind of screwed him over contract-wise, and you'd expect them to do the same for Kurt.
Right. So, yeah, that was just that whole thing, obviously, just so many weird things about that situation. But anything else notable before his time in TNA that you can think of to discuss here that important for context?
I think it's worth mentioning just how injured he was said to be, because when we get into the match, it was a hard-hitting affair. You know,
oh, Samoa gosh. Joe,
Samoa Joe does not, you know, wrestle lightly, especially not in this era. I think his style has changed quite a bit between then and now. But this was a hard-hitting, violent match that he was wrestling, and I think there's just a little bit. I remember watching it at the time going, dude's got a broken neck, or, you know, dude left this company because of neck injuries and he's doing this.
Yeah. Yeah. It was insane. I mean, it was very, there's a couple of bumps here that are just like unbelievable for anyone, and particularly somebody with the injuries that, you know, he has, or, you know, are reported to have or whatever. I mean, you can see that he's, you know, dealt with injuries throughout his career, just in his body changes and how he moves and all those different things. And what's been documented is, you know, enough, much less what is rumored.
Yeah. You know, there's stuff that's documented, the broken neck and all of that. And then there's sure. The rumors that, you know, things like the night before WrestleMania 19, I think it was, that he spent the night in the hospital. Basically, I like to think that him and Steve Austin were in beds next to each other that night.
Right.
And that Vince McMahon was outside the room praying.
Yes.
Just weeping and sobbing into his hands, wondering what he was going to do and if him and Hulk could go on last. But, yeah, I definitely... Kurt's been hurt a lot. And that's shown. I mean, and he's a guy with... He's one of the few wrestlers with a broken neck who never went and had the big surgery. Right. The one that Benoit had that took him out for a year. That's a great example to start things off with. The one that Austin had that put him out for a year. The one that Edge had. You know, he never went and had that surgery. And another thing that I found when looking up interviews from him with this time is he basically said that the neck fusion surgery is barbaric and that what he did is actually a more advanced surgery, which, you know, people in the NFL are still getting their necks fused and all of that. So I don't know if it's exactly as barbaric as Kurt likes to say.
Sure. It is possible that Kurt may not have the best grasp on reality. Just the theory I'm going to throw out there.
That it's likely. I think it's very likely that he might not have the best grasp on reality.
Yeah. So Angle comes in. There's this video promo. I believe it's at the end of No Surrender. There's a great clip on YouTube of even like of like post match of or post show. It wasn't aired, but somehow the Raw clip came out of Tanae and Don West just going crazy and everyone and just the excitement in that building when he comes. I mean, it was a huge surprise. I mean, I don't think anyone there. I know there was some thought that it might be Goldberg coming in because they were, you know, obviously building up to a big announcement, but I don't think that it happened, I guess, so quickly after the situation and everyone thought that Angle was in such bad shape that I guess maybe that was a theory floating around, but it certainly wasn't like a thing that people knew was going to happen, you know?
Yeah, it was at No Surrender. They made the announcement. This is kind of all of this now kind of weaves into the narrative of where this feud starts. Right. And they made the announcement after the fans' revenge strap match that we should talk about on a podcast sometime between Jeff Jarrett and Samoa Joe. And this was Jarrett was the NWA champion at the time, and this was a non-title match. Basically, they let 20 fans stand at ringside with belts. And when Jarrett got thrown out of the ring, the fans at ringside got to hit Jarrett with a belt.
Yeah.
Samoa Joe won the match, pinning the NWA World Champion clean. And Samoa Joe took the belt.
Right.
And disappeared. And then Jim Cornette came to the ring to make the big announcement. He announced that TNA was going prime time. And the fans in the Impact Zone gave him their big TNA chant. And then he said, but I said there's a big announcement, and they played the Kurt Angle video, and that was the end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't, I think they were up against the clock, and there wasn't even time to react to the announcement,
okay.
Which is why TNA released the YouTube video of the fans in the Impact Zone, and, you know, Mike Tenay and Don West, I'm assuming, hugging each other and crying as it played. It sounded like Mike Tenay was crying.
He was very, very excited, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no question about it. So
and TNA's website crashed moments later, and it was not up till that morning. They ended up replacing the website with just a splash page with Kurt Angle's face on it.
Yeah. So that was insane. And then we have a few days later, Cornette announces that Angle's going to be the enforcer for Sting versus Jarrett at Bound for Glory. And then we have Angle making an appearance on Impact by getting into a confrontation with Samoa Joe, who still has possession of the NWA title belt. And then basically kind of a famous scene of Angle headbutting Samoa Joe, causing him to bleed, the two of them getting into it, having a pretty stiff, intense brawl, and then Jarrett stealing the belt or taking the belt back sort of in the midst of all that. TNA had a lot of angles where there was a lot of things going on. Anyway, I guess part of that was the compression of the only being able to have a 1 hour show. So they would do twice as much. Sometimes this is even really before Russo was involved, you know, deeply involved creatively again.
Yeah. This was when Impact, you used to watch that hour and just go, what at the end, because I would say that probably every 5 minutes of the show had a different angle happening in it.
Right.
And you know, this is an example. This was, I think it was the end of the last show before Bound for Glory, so they were in go-home mode.
Right.
And they put out two guys who weren't in the main event of the show having a confrontation. So, you know, the belt stealing back was a great way to work Jarrett into it, and a nice way to get out of Samoa Joe taking the belt, and then not a nice way to get out of Joe taking the belt, but not handing it back over, but it being taken from him because he was in a confrontation. In that stiff thing, I don't know if you mentioned this. I might have zoned out for a second if you did, but Kurt Angle headbutted Samoa Joe,
yeah,
and busted him open.
Right.
Like, that's, you know, that's pretty insane, just a headbutt. And it's not like, you know, Joe might have prepped the flesh a little bit before, but it's not like there was a whole lot of time to get that nice and tender or for him to blade.
Right. Yeah, it was, you know, it looked really great. It was really, that brawl, I think, was done perfectly. So maybe a little bit of odd timing for it, but it set up they have another confrontation at Bound for Glory when Angle is going to be the special guest referee, or I guess enforcer, I guess. And then Joe comes out and you know, they get into it again, and you know, get into sort of a bigger brawl while that's all going on, in before the Sting Jarrett match, I guess.
Yeah, I actually really liked the way that they used, I mean, in a way, that main event spotlight that should have been on Sting versus Jarrett, if, you know, that's the match you're building to. But I appreciated the way that they used that to promote the pay-per-view the next month too, and the way that they you know, they had special circumstances, but the right way that they put that together, I really appreciated.
Yeah, I think that was the right decision. You're right. I mean, you could say it, argue it detracted from the main event that you're building, but, you know, you have Angle thrown in there, and you have this heated thing, and the way they mixed it in, I thought worked pretty well. What I didn't think worked quite as well is the afterward, when we have, I guess, sort of the big Angle, the first primetime impact that you talked about, the match with Abyss, where Angle wrestles Abyss, and that's fine. They have their match, and Angle wins clean with the ankle lock, and then Joe comes in, and then they have just they brawl just for seemingly like 3 or 4 minutes. It's just like you're doing so much building to this kind of this dream match. One of the things about the dream matches is you really don't want to do too much physically, or you kind of lose the excitement of, or the novelty of, these two guys, you know, fighting for the quote first time.
Yeah, that one was a little long for me, and, you know, you had Sting get involved, and Sting and Abyss, and Angle and Joe, and everyone was going at it,
and Joe
and Abyss double-teaming Kurt Angle, which was odd, because up to this point, Joe had been a babyface. I mean, yeah, he was kind of a badass babyface and a ruthless guy when he was in the X Division, but he had been turned up to that point, so it was weird that Joe suddenly is totally chill with beating up Kurt Angle with another guy's help.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that didn't make much sense. And I think, you know, as we talk about Russo fingerprints on this, that's a Russo thing. There was a lack of character definition, and just kind of a, we'll go out there and do that this week, and we'll get to the end of the actual match on pay-per-view, and they kind of switched roles in a weird way.
Yeah. Like, I'm fine with Joe being Joe and Angle being Angle, and them not necessarily being like clear, you know, good guy, bad guy here, because, you know, this is sort of about something else. But yeah, I think Joe was too heelish in joining in that attack. I mean, it's okay if he takes advantage of Abyss attacking Angle or something sort of along those lines. He can be, you know, because you're right, he's a little cocky. He's a little, you know, he's the badass guy, so he's going to have that edge. And it's fine for Angle to have that edge because that's part of his character too. But this is sort of something where, you know, you can be a little more fluid with the face heel roles, but you don't want to have a guy go too far in it, or else it's going to undercut kind of what makes the chemistry between them that makes it special.
Yeah, I think that one, you know, if they wanted to straight up just turn Samoa Joe heel the second they knew that Kurt Angle was coming in, That would have made sense to me. And if they, because they would want to, you know, Angle obviously when he comes in is going to be a babyface. You're not gonna, you're not getting out of that one.
Right.
So you need to make someone into a strong heel for him to go against. And Samoa Joe would have been a fine option for that at the time.
Right.
If they want to go with those roles. But if you're not going to define them, I believe that they made a mistake by having Joe, like we're saying, Joe acts like such a jerk. And to me, the main thing is teaming up with Abyss to beat up Kurt Angle.
Right.
I think, you know, if he would have teamed up with Kurt Angle to get Abyss out of the ring and then kick Kurt Angle's ass, it would have been a totally different situation.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. So that one wasn't really quite that was sort of weird. But I think most of the build was pretty strong.
Mm-hmm. That one segment with the headbutt, that is still, you know, they were just replaying the heck out of that for the TNA 10th anniversary show this year, and it's, you know, it's 6 years later that they're still talking about it. That was a great moment.
Yeah, yeah, and this match is really great too. I mean, it's really, you know, they excellent stuff. So I guess we'll go ahead and get into it. Oh, the other thing about the and I guess this was a problem with Impact. I mean, it's sort of been a problem with TNA forever, but particularly during the Abyss, the double teaming and then Sting being involved, and then we have Abyss taking Sting to the back, and you see Sting sort of hanging upside down and Abyss attacking him. Sting's face is covered. I'm not even sure if that's Sting, to be honest. I think it might have been a body double. It could have been Sting, I'm not sure, but regardless, you have these two separate things, and you just have the announcers just yelling and yelling and yelling, and you have the whole thing, like,
yeah,
every single thing, it's yelling and yelling and yelling, and just, that's sort of one reason why I've never really been able to stick with TNA for very long or watch whole shows that much, is because, geez, I just don't want to be yelled at. I have a tolerance for that is not very long, so.
And that was definitely a trademark of the Don West era on commentary in TNA. And I don't know. I still have a hard time deciding if I want yelling at me all the time Don West or if I want thoroughly unmotivated Taz talking to me with Mike Tanay about wrestling. But watching this match, I will take this Don West every day of the week.
This fit the atmosphere, so it was fine. But a lot of the other things, it's just like, oh, you know, stop it. Calm down, guys. It's okay. You can build up to those big things. You know, it doesn't have to be every single. It's like music. It's like if every single note is as loud as possible, you know, you're not going to get the dynamics.
Yeah. Can someone tell the crowd that too? And the Impact Zone?
Yeah. Well, this worked though. This one, they were pretty good. Although I do have to say that 3 seconds into the lockup chanting, "This is awesome," that's a little much, guys.
Yeah. I thought that was the most egregious thing that the crowd did during this, was just, "This is awesome, guys. They just locked up. This match could suck. You don't want to endorse it too soon.
Right.
At least let them get through the headlock."
Yeah. But they're into the whole thing. There's not a moment they're not passionate about, which is nice. I mean, yeah, some of the chants were a little silly. I've ranted about that before. I'm not going to repeat that here. But yeah, they were certainly passionate about it, and they were pretty invested in the story of the match, and that's all I could ask for.
And this was a time to me when the Impact Zone still seemed like a place that I would want to go and visit to watch a wrestling show.
Uh-huh.
It was towards the end of that time. But there was a time with TNA when they managed to make the Impact Zone not the, you know, we look at it now almost as, yep, a bunch of tourists are crammed into a soundstage at Universal Studios. Right. Let's watch us some TNA Impact. But the crowds were usually hot for these shows. The crowds were into it, and even if they were a little too chanty because they wanted desperately to be in, you know, the ECW arena in 1995.
Right.
They were at least into the show and paying attention, even if they were trying to upstage the show a little bit. And, you know, again, it's, do you want a crowd constantly yelling, or do you want a crowd unmotivated just waiting for the Hulk Hogan appearance?
I will take the first, even with the flaws of the first. So I'll certainly give you that. This is called the Dream Match of the Decade. Certainly great. One thing we need to talk about before we get in the match, though, that just realized the promo setting this up for both Joe and Angle. Interesting the dynamic, because Joe seems very natural and very intense and very focused, and I really felt that Joe's promos, they kind of show some of the training and stuff and so on and so forth, that Joe's is really good, very understated, while Angle just comes off really forced, not only in the promos for Joe, but in the stuff in which, you know, he's talking about leaving WWE, and he's talking about, like, coming to TNA, and it feels like home, and it feels like, you know, so on and so forth. Like, he just really, really seems forced, and like he's deluding himself.
Yeah, like, the video, TNA posted a behind-the-scenes video of, like, Terry Taylor picking up Kurt Angle at an airport Starbucks, and Kurt gets into the car and is like, yeah, this already feels like home. And I'm like, dude, you just left the Starbucks at the airport. Did they give you your coffee for free? Is that what's going on? You know? And he, let me point out, too, if you watch this video, he nurses that cup of coffee. I mean, when you see him backstage talking to Rhino and some other people, unless that was all filmed within 10 minutes, Kurt Angle takes forever to drink a cup of coffee.
He does.
That frustrates me as a coffee lover that consumes my coffee very quickly.
I see. He's Shane Douglas is back there. He runs with Jerry Lynn, AJ Styles. He talks to. Yeah, that was sort of an interesting video clip as well, which I'd never seen. And you just kind of throughout it. I mean, it just sort of feels like I was watching another video clip most of Angle's tenure throughout, like basically through the beginning through Main Event Mafia. And when he's sort of being the, when he sort of turns heel in the middle of 07 and collects all the belts and so on and so forth, it's like, okay, this feels much more like the Kurt Angle that I recognize, and kind of the cocky, arrogant Kurt Angle. And that seemed to suit him more than the, you know, really intense, really excited to be here, Kurt Angle, which is weird just considering Angle has those bona fides and is really tough and, of course, great wrestler.
Yeah, so, and it's
interesting how the personality kind of differs from the skill set in a way.
Yeah, I think that's always been an issue with Angle, dating back to his WWE days, is, yeah, he can get kind of intense, and, yeah, he's this great wrestler in the ring, and he can have your 17-star match if you want him to. But his skill set is comedy. His skill set is, he does realism all right, but his skill set is kind of being goofy. And Kurt Angle comes off goofy sometimes when he's trying to be intense.
Right.
A good example is that video that they played with him. We didn't talk about the actual content of the video they played, aside from that it said Kurt Angle is coming, but it had Kurt Angle kind of shadow boxing, and I think for a few minutes in it, you were supposed to think it was Goldberg because right. They showed the bald head and all of that. But then you saw the American flag and they said Olympic gold medalist. And I really wish that they would have left, the microphones in the impact zone on, because I'm guessing that pop was more than even the celebration that they released on YouTube. I'm guessing that was probably one of the more epic moments in the history of that building.
Yeah.
But then Angle goes, it's real. It's damn real. And maniacally laughs for
right.
some
reason.
Yeah. Like, with a mouthpiece, and he's just like, ha, 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 ha.
You captured that well. Well done.
Yeah, it's goofy. Like, he's trying to be intense, and he comes off as goofy.
Yes.
That's where I was going with that.
That's absolutely correct. Yes, that is exactly the way it came across as well. So it just comes off as strange. And I guess linking that to the personal problems that we know that he had, it just makes it all seem like not quite a farce, but it seems like, Kurt, what are you doing? You seem like you're in denial. There's no question about that. But then it leads to this tremendous match with this tremendous environment. So, I don't know. Pro wrestling's weird.
Yeah, pro wrestling's really weird. But then again, I mean, thinking of another, you know, tremendous match, if you were to look at Shawn Michaels in 1997 going into the Hell in a Cell match with Undertaker, Michaels had, you know, probably had some drug issues at the time, if we're being realistic, probably yeah. similar ones, actually. He had had the knee injury and the smile, whatever, you know, and he had lost his smile and all of that, and he's coming back, and then he has that amazing Hell in a Cell match with Undertaker that is just awesome. Right. Like, it's one of my favorite matches to this day, and you just go, how did this guy, who was such a D-bag at the time, pull this off? And I don't even think Kurt Angle comes off as that much of, you know, a bad person at this time. I mean, he definitely doesn't sound, you know, he definitely isn't all that great, but he doesn't come off as bad of a person as Shawn Michaels in 1997, that's for sure.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. So, we have, like I said, dream match of the decade. Maybe a little much, but I guess for TNA, you know, you're going to hype it, you might as well hype it big. And we have Jeremy Borash doing ring intros. He has, now I'm usually kind of a fan of Jeremy Borash, but he's got a loud red collar here. It looks like it's
from
the 70s.
Oh my God, it's huge.
He's got frosted tips. That is very not buffer. So
yeah. Well, his collar itself, I mean, that thing looked like it could have eaten his head. it was pretty large, and then the frosted tip.
And Borash is a pretty big head too, so you have to consider that. Yeah.
Borash in this era was not, because I watched some of the intros too for and some of the match of Jeff Jarrett versus Sting from Bound for Glory 2006, and this era of Jeremy Borash, you're just like, dude, can someone please drop a copy of GQ on his doorstep, in his office, whatever. Let's leave the frosted tips at home, little less gel, and scale down the collar. You're going to be fine, Jeremy. You're going to be fine.
Yeah. Well, he's bounced back nicely since then, so we'll give him credit for that. And we have a great atmosphere for the intros, as it is throughout the entire thing, as we've said. It just, it's very, very loud, very, very boisterous. Good times. Earl Hebner is a referee, although that doesn't really come into play other than, you know, no shenanigans with the referee here, so I guess that's good. This is not really the type of match where you want to have shenanigans with the referee, so at least they were able to TNA as a... Well, I mean, not just TNA, but certainly TNA has its fair share of main events with a lot of ref bumps and silliness. So that was basically avoided here.
Yeah, and I wondered at the time, I think it was Rudy Charles, who was the TNA senior referee. And I wondered watching this if Earl Hebner was put in for this match because of his familiarity with Angle.
Huh.
You know, one of the reasons was that, you know, he's worked with him. I want to say that it was Hebner who, you know, he had refereed quite a few Kurt Angle matches in the past. I want to say it was Hebner that refed Shawn Michaels versus Kurt Angle at WrestleMania 21, but Hebner might have been fired for t-shirt selling by then.
No, it wasn't. He was released in July of 05, so just a few months later.
Okay, so yeah, I think it was Hebner that did that, and so I think Hebner had a good familiarity and a chemistry with Angle as a referee that, you know, could have made this match better. It might have, just a little bit, compared to if Angle was trying to get used to getting signals from Rudy Charles or another TNA referee.
Yeah, that's good insight. I hadn't thought of that, but that makes pretty good sense. So we're tentative into the lockup. Angle tries to take him down. We get a corner break and a quick "This is awesome" chant, as we said before. Angle eventually gets a single leg takedown and a rope break when Joe grabs the ropes. We have a "Joe's gonna kill you" chant. So we're chanty early. Joe finally gets a pretty good shot in, pounds Angle along the ropes, gets a big headbutt and some stiff kicks. Then Angle is able to take control, gets a few boots, and hits a belly-to-belly, and then clotheslines Joe over the top rope. So we get some intense action pretty quickly. Then a pretty incredible spot. Joe grabs Angle by the feet while he's on the apron, sort of holds him in a powerbomb position, pulls him out, and swings him really hard into the barricade, the steel barricade. And that's a pretty big ouch.
Yeah, that spot, I mean, and he swung Angle like shoulder and head first into that barricade. Like that, you know, that's why I said we really should mention how banged up Angle was suspected to be, because you watch this and you just go, why? Why would a guy with, in his own words, a broken freaking neck do this?
Yeah. And I guess the answer is that Angle just can't help himself. He's, you know, I mean, it's not like he's really, I mean, he maybe slowed down a bit since then, but, you know, 6 years later, he's still in TNA and he's still, you know, been in lots of main events over the years and done a lot of crazy things, moonsaults off cages and so on and so forth. So
I might be wrong, but I think Angle and Joe did that same spot in their recent Impact main event.
Wow.
And I remember talking about it and being impressed with it. You know, I think that was, what, like a month ago now. But just going, wow, Angle took that move. And then I was watching this and I'm like, you're kidding me.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty incredible. So we a flaw in this match and a flaw kind of with Kurt Angle in general, and not just him, is that we get in the ring and Kurt Angle's fine a few seconds later. It's like Angle does have a tendency to sort of wrestle like a robot. And I guess it's sort of part of the character because he's this wrestling machine, you know, especially at certain times. But I do feel like, wow, yeah, we definitely are, you know, that's something that violent maybe should be sold for just a little bit longer.
Yeah. I felt like that with a lot of parts of this match, that they were almost working, and I think it was Angle trying to prove that he could work this pace.
Yeah.
I feel like they were almost working a Ring of Honor type of pace here, where it's very fast, it's very spotty, it's let's just cram everything we can in, and that's also a trademark of some early TNA matches. And at this time, we talked about Joe's style. Joe was very much working his Ring of Honor style still in TNA, which is hard hitting. It's everything that this match was, but they could have taken probably, this match could have added 5 minutes and not added any spots, and it probably would have been just as good.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a good point. So Angle gets an uppercut, misses a charge in the corner, and then charges in his shoulder, goes into the post. Then Joe does a dive, elbow suicida is as it is called by Tanay, which sort of grazes Angle, but then Angle slams really hard into the barricade again. And then Joe gets up, grabs Angle around the ring and throws him really hard and fiercely into the ring steps. Now, at this point, Angle is he doesn't get up from this very quickly. Joe and Hebner, in fact, jaw around in the ring for a bit. Hebner counts a bit, but then Joe gets into it with him again to break the count. So that gives Angle some time to actually sell the impact of this heavy violence, you know, rather than just popping up again very quickly.
It also gives Angle some time to blade.
Yes, that is...
without popping up quickly and to get it really flowing, because Angle pops up from this pretty bloody at that point, and it had to be one heck of a blade job, because by the end of this match, he was basically drenched in his blood. It wasn't quite Great Muta status, but it was getting there.
Yeah, you're right. And it was... he comes out, he's got the bloody forehead, he slowly slides into the ring, and then Joe goes after it really intensely. I mean, with headbutt, he gets, you know, the blood, in fact, the blood gets on Joe's head, using his fingers to kind of like pry open the cut, which is really a great visual, but obviously, you know, very gross as well. And you get the angle, the blood spreads over Angle's body, shoulders in particular, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Then Angle makes a bit of a fiery comeback, then runs into a power slam, but Joe sort of does a lazy cover. We only get two. Joe gets a bunch of forearms to Angle's head. We get dueling Joe and Angle chance. Then Angle pops up, gets some uppercuts, but Joe gets a tilt-a-whirl backbreaker off the ropes for two. Angle at this point sort of begs off a little bit onto the turnbuckle. Joe lifts him up onto the ropes. They trade slaps. Angle gets a front face lock, and Joe lifts him up kind of in the muscle buster position, but they sort of struggle to get to each sort of battle for leverage, and then Angle kind of gets a DDT off of that. And I thought that was a really well-crafted struggle they had there. It wasn't just like the typical, okay, the guy's obviously coming off and going to get the DDT. They kind of both sort of were working against each other there, and that, I thought, made it look pretty cool and different.
I think that was kind of the beginning of what Angle and Joe would begin to explore style-wise as they had more and more matches together. And you look at, I think that they get better with almost every match that they have together as you watch Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe. It's really a heck of a series if you go and you watch their match the next month and their Iron Man match and their match for all the belts. And then you finally watch their Lockdown 2008 match, which style-wise, I think that's I mention all of this because style-wise, I think that that struggle was a lot of what they ended up doing in the Lockdown 2008 cage match, where they had kind of this hybrid MMA / pro wrestling style of match where they were both, you know, they were really walking a line of both styles, where everything looked like it was a struggle, and it wasn't, well, this guy's easily going to go up for the suplex, but no, we're going to fight for it, and he's going to win and get the suplex.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've reviewed that. It's been a while since I reviewed it, but yeah, I had a podcast on that match as well, and that's definitely a good observation. After that, they trade punches, which Joe wins. But he misses a charge, and Angle gets a German suplex. Joe tries to fight out of the second one, but Angle's able to lift him up for the second. Then Angle lifts him up for the third, but sort of drops, instead of dropping him backward, he sort of drops him off to the side, and Joe sort of lands on his belly and gets a two count. Looked pretty vicious anyway. In fact, maybe even more vicious than a regular German would have looked.
I actually thought that that was Joe countering. Him kind of jumping out of the German suplex. It could have been either, but either way, it didn't look like it felt good.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of why the way the announcers called it, or at least they called it as if he wasn't able to hit it. But it looked like, you know, to me, it looked like something that was pretty close to as vicious. So it was effective either way. Angle tries the Olympic slam, but Joe gets an arm drag and a clothesline. Then he lands a kick to the face while Angle is on the ropes. Then it has been picked up. Then he gets the muscle buster, his finisher, or at least his pinfall finisher, but it only gets two. We get another "This is awesome" chant, and I'm very much more inclined to agree at this point that the match is pretty awesome.
Yeah, I think we could certify it awesome at this point, and I was not upset at the crowd at that moment.
No.
Although I did get a little peeved because there's like four guys in the front row that if you watch them when they're doing the Angle Joe dueling chants, they are chanting for both, and that is not okay.
No, I guess you got to pick one or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joe tries to lock in a rear naked choke, but Angle slips out of it. He gets the Olympic slam, and it gets two. And we have make him tap chance. Angle gets very, very intense, takes off the strap. He locks in the ankle lock. Joe tries to roll through a couple of times, but Angle keeps it on. But on the second time, Joe is able to lock in the choke, countering it. That was a cool-looking counter. It looks like Angle is pretty close to tapping after, probably 30, 45 seconds in the hold. And Angle probably had the ankle lock in for about the same amount of time. Finally, Angle's able to grab the ankle, turn and get out of it, pulls Joe away from the ropes. Joe is able to push Angle into the corner, but then he misses a charge. Angle lands the Olympic Slam, and then he puts the straps on and then puts them back down, which is apparently, you know, wrestling magic that works. So whatever, you know. It's not nearly as cool as when Jerry Lawler would do something like that, but, you know, but whatever.
Jerry Lawler taking the strap down is way cooler than Kurt Angle doing it. That's pretty much, you know, that in any context, Jerry Lawler taking the strap down is cooler. I really enjoyed this. It got intense. I thought that the crowd added to it. Like, Impact Zone crowds don't get credit for doing that often. Mm-hmm. With the This Is Awesome chant, with the Make Him Tap chant,
yeah.
I mean, that's an atmosphere that you don't get anywhere else. And I would argue that you don't get anywhere but in a smaller building.
Yeah.
You don't have fans at, you know, a 70,000-seat arena stadium for WrestleMania that into it. But, you know, these fans, there was an atmosphere about it. And, you know, again, the Impact Zone felt like a destination at this point in time. And that was part of the atmosphere, is that you can get intense in this small play area, and you're not seeing the indie-rific show with bad lighting, but that you're going to see a, you know, a well-produced, good wrestling show with stars you know, and, you know, laser tag apparently happening in the background, but that you're going to see something special.
Sure, sure. And it felt like, at least for this one match, it felt almost like a Memphis studio wrestling type atmosphere or Georgia Championship Wrestling studio atmosphere, where the crowd is such a, you know, obviously souped up production, but you kind of got that same, you know, organic sense of the crowd really, you know, interacting with them in a way and feeding them and them feeding the crowd. You got that connection that is missing in a lot of wrestling today, and may not have even been, you know, may have been a rarity even then, you know, in the 80s when those studio shows were popular, but still, you know, it kind of, that magic kind of translated, at least, you know, at least a bit of it.
Yeah. The atmosphere, you know, we're talking about it. I think this match would be really good, but it would not be as great as we're saying it is if the atmosphere wasn't there. And the atmosphere really made it. And, you know, maybe it's just that Tanay and Don West went out there and did what they always do, but because it was so loud behind them for the entire match, and because there was just this, you know, this buzzing energy underneath the match the entire time, that everything seems better because the atmosphere was that good.
Yeah, yeah. And after the double, the straps on, straps off, we get another ankle lock by Angle, and the fans are just even more intense. And Joe tries to get to the rope. He reaches out. He can't get there. He finally taps. They got a great close up of Joe trying to get there. And of course an Angle after he wins, and just really, really great. Tanay and West are great at getting over, you know, the end of Samoa Joe's streak, the momentum, the level of stakes that, you know, that this, the big moment, making the big moment seem right and making it, you know, appropriate and letting it sink in, I guess. All that I thought really worked very, very well. And we see Angle jumping on the rope and celebrating, and, you know, Joe obviously trying to recover, and just really good stuff.
Yeah, they I really enjoyed the call at the end of the match. I criticize Mike Tanay a lot and say that he cannot make the trademark call mm-hmm. that a announcer should be able to make. He, you know, and I don't mean the cliche call, but the real, this is, you know, you can't point to a lot of Mike Tanay on commentary and go, that was vintage Mike Tanay, if you will, the way you can with Jim Ross, where he gets made fun of for his call of Stone Cold or whatever. But that comes from the fact that in the beginning, at WrestleMania 14. That was a brilliant call.
Sure.
Mike Tenay does not have many of those, but I think this is almost as close as he comes as a commentator, really getting across the story and the point that had to be made.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And there are things I like about Tenay, and I think Tenay was suited for the analyst-type role and was good in that, but as a lead guy just doesn't have those skills that you described. Afterward, we have Joe grabbing the mic as Angle is left or heading out of the ring. Joe yells Angle, and we get a "you tapped out" chant, and then Joe says something like, "Yeah, you're damn right I did, but I knew, you know, I was beaten. I knew that you were the better man this time." Joe challenges him to a rematch, extends his hand, and the crowd chants one more time. They're excited at this prospect. Angle goes to reach his hand out, but then pulls it back and walks away. So sort of a weird, sort of what you referred to as Angle kind of coming across as the heel and Joe coming across as the good guy there. So you hear Angle's music as in he leaves. And then afterward, Joe says, "Angle, I guess we got to do this the hard way." So teasing to, the match they would have the next month. And I will say that I do think that probably they may have done the match too much too quickly. Like if they had let Angle do something else, let Joe kind of do something else, and then come back to it in 2 or 3 months and let it give it some time to breathe and kind of build it back up big again, I think that might have been a better story than what they did. Even though, obviously, yeah, they had a good rivalry and they had some great matches, but I feel like it sort of took the specialness away from it too quickly.
Well, I was amazed that they went to this feud as Kurt Angle's first feud in TNA. I was really surprised at that because I thought that, you know, you've got this guy, Kurt Angle, coming in. You want to, before you, I guess, launch into the dream match, per se, you want to get people familiar with him, let him get entrenched in your organization, and have him win a couple feuds first. I think there were guys like Abyss that he could have gotten into the ring with at first, and even a feud with Jeff Jarrett would have made sense, but they launched straight into the Joe feud, which really surprised me.
Yeah, I actually think that was a good move, though, because, I mean, I feel like once you have Angle become like a normal guy, like a normal part of the roster, I feel like the match with Joe loses its specialness a little bit, especially given TNA's lack of ability to build, special feuds, that they sort of demonstrated against them. I feel like it would have been lessened had they just brought him in and done sort of normal feuds before building this one thing. I mean, I'm sure they could have made it work, but I feel like this way, I think it may have worked out better.
That's a really good point. And I also, at the time I was going, is TNA not sure that they have that Angle? This is a very cynical way to look at things, but I was looking at it basically saying, is TNA not sure that Angle's going to be around in a year to have this match? I had those fears.
And maybe that's possible. I mean, maybe it's sort of like, the feelings that people had when Brock Lesnar and John Cena was done right away, Extreme Rules 2012. So, and honestly, kind of the build for that, there was some similarities to that for sure, and
there were a lot of them.
Even the match itself,
that
their increased physicality, and now the story there was Lesnar dominated, it for a good bit, but still, there was certainly there's certainly some parallels to both those situations.
Yeah, that's actually a really good comparison. That they had the big confrontation where someone came up bleeding. They had the sort of weird promos.
Yeah,
it was all kind of there. How did you feel about the decision to end Joe's undefeated streak right now? Or at this moment?
I feel like it probably was about time to do it. But I feel like he should have come off of this been rebuilt and then kind of been put into the title picture, and then maybe you bring back Angle and Joe, and this time it's for the title, you know? Or you could have Angle be the champion, and you know, and then build Joe back up and have. Actually, that's probably better since Joe lost the first match, to have Angle win the title, Joe be built back as the contender, then do it again. And then maybe Joe wins the second one, and then you build the third one. But I mean, I feel like I'm not sure what else you do with the undefeated streak, and I feel like this brings Angle win with a bang and gives him a whole lot, and then. You know, he's still hot off of this, and you can put him right in that world title situation. And you've got plenty of new and fresh opponents for Angle to kind of work with. I mean, you obviously have your Jarrett and your Stings and, you know, even Abyss, so on and so forth.
And booking-wise, it seems like that's what they were going to do. If you look at, you know, the just 3 days before this, Kurt Angle defeated Abyss on Impact.
Right.
Abyss on this show wins the world title. If I were a betting man at that moment, I would have said, cool, Angle beats Abyss at the next pay-per-view, and maybe in a month or two, two or three months, they go back to Angle versus Joe, and this time it's for the world title.
Right.
And I probably would have predicted that that's when Joe wins his first world title.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we had to wait, like, 2 more years for that, but it definitely was an odd thing that happened when they went right back to Angle and Joe.
Yeah,
it was definitely weird. Did you feel? I felt like this match was a little bit short. It clocked in at 13 minutes.
Oh, really? I honestly felt like it really was the length it should have been. You know, like, mm-hmm. I didn't feel like it. I guess they crammed a lot of stuff in, so I guess it could have been longer, and we could have had, you know, if we'd have had a little more of the selling of some of the big bumps, I would have been happier with that. But it wasn't like it didn't feel like a short match to me. I guess it felt like a fast-paced match, and a match that crammed a lot of things in, but it wasn't like I thought it was closer to the 20-minute mark, or, you know, like the high teens. I didn't realize that it was quite that short. I guess the post-match stuff helped, because there's a decent amount of the post-match stuff would kind of make the match itself feel longer.
That is true. It does. You don't... I felt like... I think I paused it right when the match ended or something to take a couple notes, and I felt like at that moment, that was it. This is the big epic match I remember. I mean, it was suitably epic, but big. I'm not quite sure. But then you watch the post-match and you go... Okay, well, we're getting there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have, because after this, we have the rematch at the next pay-per-view, which Joe wins by submission. Then we have Final Resolution, January of 07, Angle beats Joe in a 30-minute Iron Man match. Then we have Angle and Christian at the next pay-per-view against all odds, which Christian actually wins the match to hold the title. So I guess he regained the title at some point from Abyss. And I forget if Christian had turned by then, but I think he had at that point. Cause I think he turned I forget if he turned before Russo came in or if he turned afterward. I know he turned at some point around this time.
I think it was shortly after Russo came in.
Okay, and then he had the stable with AJ Styles as sort of the comedic lackey, which was weird given AJ's, you know, being kind of the main event guy at least a main event guy and sort of the heart of and soul of TNA guy for, you know, a decent amount of time when that's not wasn't Jarrett's role. Mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. And Tomko also being added there. So, Angle was just kind of thrown in. Yeah. So he faces Scott Steiner next at Destination X. And then there's the team Angle team, Christian Cage, which, in Angle's teaming with Samoa Joe and Rhino and Sting and Jeff Jarrett. I guess that was when they brought back Jeff Jarrett. I think Jarrett was out after a long absence, and he came back as a babyface.
Yeah, he was out for a long absence, and they ran this angle with kind of, you know, Sting and everyone going, can we trust Jeff Jarrett? Are we going to be able to trust him? And it turns out they could trust him.
Right, right. Go ahead.
This is actually right before Jeff Jarrett's wife passed away.
That's right. And then he had another long absence after that, obviously. Yeah. And then they came back and they did a pretty big Jarrett Angle feud, I believe in 08. And then, of course, they did the other big feud last year over, Karen divorcing Jeff and marrying, divorcing Kurt and marrying Jeff. And taking that real life thing and making that a big story. Certainly Angle fought a variety of guys in the next year, I felt like they burned through the Joe thing, and Joe kind of got lost in the shuffle in 07 and then kind of developed like a sort of a weird whiny character for a while and turned heel and kind of had a character that didn't really suit him that sort of went kind of against, the badass thing. And then kind of when they brought it back eventually, and he had that effective, lockdown, the match that you mentioned, the big one at lockdown. But by then, it was sort of, it wasn't like it was too late, but it certainly probably would have had more emotional resonance if he had come off the loss, if they had rebuilt him and then he beats Angle for the title, say, sometime, spring, summer of 07, let's say Slammiversary 07, and, that's kind of his coronation as being, okay, now you're the next, now you're the next big thing.
Yeah, there was that weird match in the middle there, Kurt Angle versus Samoa Joe at Hard Justice 2007, where Kurt Angle was TNA and IWGP world champions, and Samoa Joe was the world tag team champions.
That's right.
Explain that one. Right. And the exhibition champion. And they had that kind of odd winner-take-all match. And that was one of those examples of going to the well on this feud that I thought really ended up hurting the feud in the long run, where they couldn't get it right with Samoa Joe. And he floundered for so long until that lockdown match.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the creative just kind of got worse and worse in 07 behind it, too, and that didn't help either. So I think it's just a bad pacing and not great stories and overdoing it. I think that's not a good combination.
Yeah, that is not promising. I mean, they really did pace things in an odd way. They had his weird alliance with Kevin Nash around that time too.
Right. Yeah. So a lot of weird stuff going on with Joe. It really, basically the last 4 or 5 years, it really, since this point, I mean, they did everything right with Joe basically leading up to this. And, but it never really, for whatever reason, they didn't seem to have the confidence to get behind him as as their guy and as their homegrown guy, and at least in nothing long term. So then in that, it seemed like he had everything going for him, popular with the fans, was different, was unique, good promo, I mean, just kind of everything was working pretty well. But for whatever reason, it just didn't quite happen the way that it looked like it could at one point.
Yeah, it was even after the match in 2008, after the title match, they had built up Joe's journey for so long that they almost seemed lost on what to do with him as champion.
Right.
I guess no one could borrow some tapes of Vader from, 1992 and 1993 from the WWE tape library.
Sure.
They don't have that deep a connection. They definitely just seemed lost on what to do with him. And really, since then, Joe has flashes of what he did in that first 18 months with the undefeated streak, and he has flashes of that intensity, but he has never quite gotten to that level again.
Right, right. I would agree with that. As far as Kurt Angle goes, it seems like going with TNA was basically the right move for his career and his life. He certainly had his issues, you know, since then he's had some arrests for DUI and some, you know, there's certainly rumors of, you know, I'm not saying his life is by any means perfect or necessarily good, but as far as being in a situation where, you know, it seemed like, you know, his health was in severe jeopardy, his life was in severe jeopardy, and if he continued his career, he wasn't going to, you know, last long, you know, so forth. It seems like, you know, he's managed to be in TNA for 6 years, and certainly the part-time schedule, I guess, helped him. Maybe the atmosphere was better for him or whatever. Now, of course, you know, he also, his wife was on TV and their relationship disintegrated. And so there's certainly huge negatives. I guess this is more like on a relative scale of wrestling or of what was going on in his life beforehand, but it seems like at least he managed to continue his career and be somewhat okay-ish, maybe.
I doubt Kurt Angle would still be wrestling today if he had stayed with WWE. Mm-hmm. Because that schedule, even if they give him, or really unless they give him the Shawn Michaels Undertaker from a couple years ago, Undertaker's schedule now is like 3 appearances a year.
Right.
It's awesome. I want to work that. But, yeah. If they were to give him that type of schedule, you get this a long time off in the summer, and even when you are around, you're never really on house shows. You might have to go to Raw and SmackDown in the same week, and we'll use you on the occasional pay-per-view. Even if they did that for Angle, his schedule still probably would not be as easy as his schedule with TNA was. And, you know, TNA is starting to ramp things up and run more house shows now. I think they're on the road pretty often, house show-wise, which is awesome for them as a company. But their schedule is getting more and more difficult. And I would be surprised if Angle is still wrestling in 2 or 3 years as well. Kind of a funny thing when you talk about drug issues, that's not directly Angle related, but Dixie talked in a lot of interviews around when she brought Kurt Angle in. Again, a lot of conference calls around this time, hyping the big Kurt Angle acquisition. And she was asked by people about their drug testing policy, and she said that, you know, people in TNA are clean, they're tested and all of that. And I remember reading in Dustin Rhodes' book about him doing cocaine in the back in the TNA locker room. And I was just like, and that was after this time. I think he was in there as Black Rain around 2007, 2008. Well, you know, sure, Dixie, they're totally tested.
Yes. And obviously TNA does not have the best reputation when it comes to the wellness issues. Let's say, not that WWE's is fantastic or anything, but you know, they at least have that the testing and the policy, and it, you know, seems to have maybe made some difference, but it has at least some teeth to it. You can make arguments whether it's consistently applied, and there's certainly lots of whispers and gossip about that. But yeah, as far as TNA goes, you know, and in fairness to them, as a smaller company with less resources, it is hard. Testing is expensive, and you know, providing, you know, the benefits that even WWE does is expensive. So you understand the financial challenges that they face when they have trouble, when they may be having trouble with other things too.
Yeah. They don't have the money to dedicate towards the comprehensive policy or even really to put people through, huge amounts of rehab. In that same time, Dustin Rhodes, when he quit TNA, called WWE and they put him through rehab. And, you know, we've seen that with other wrestlers piecing out of TNA to get their rehab on with the WWE sponsored policy. And, you know, kudos to WWE for doing that for wrestlers. And I'm pretty sure that's what they wanted to do for Kurt Angle, to bring this around to the beginning of our conversation.
Right. Exactly. So, anything else you can think of to talk about as far as the match or anything surrounding it goes?
No, it's a great match and well worth going out of your way to watch. Joe was doing amazing work at this point in time. I would say probably 05, 06 are the best 2 years of his career if you're just talking about match quality. And not exactly story-wise, but he just plowed through people, and it was a joy to watch because Joe had entertaining matches.
Yeah, yeah, and he was a different type of character, and he and it, it really, you know, it it fit very well. It was great, and unfortunately, yeah, the a lot of promise that wasn't fulfilled later, you know, for like the reasons that we've talked about, but certainly. Yeah, this as a moment in time, it's really fun to watch and fascinating given all the context we've talked about. But just as a match itself, it's really super entertaining. So I'm glad you picked this.
Yeah, I am too. It was fun to dig in and do the research on talking about Angle, you know, going through leaving WWE and everything. And it gave me a chance to watch Kurt Angle versus Sabu today. So always that.
Yeah, there is always that. Yeah. Speaking of guys who have a few issues with substance abuse, Sabu, I, for those who might be listening to this at a later time, there's been some videos of Sabu that have come out showing him in a state of not good. And I have some photos. I don't know if there's video. I know there's definitely photos. There may be a new video that even like came out like today. But I think I heard something about that. I'm not sure. But yeah. But so anyway, so don't do drugs, kids. That's my that's my advice. Stay out of drugs.
That's the lesson of this podcast. Don't do drugs. You'll end up having a great match with Samoa Joe.
Exactly. Yes, that's that's the way. That's the lesson here. So Will, you want to anything that you would like to plug? You should do that now.
Yeah, sure. Guys, check out ProWrestling.net for your wrestling news scoops, if you will. We aren't one of those sites that copy and paste from other people, and you know we don't post things unless we're absolutely sure they're real and have happened. Jason Powell runs the site, one of the most connected guys in the wrestling media, great sources, and he'll flat out say sometimes to us on staff, "I heard this from three people, but I still don't believe it, so I'm not posting it." So, you know, he's pretty legit. And if you want more wrestling snarktitude from me, follow me on Twitter at It's Will Time.
All right. Well, Will, thank you so much for being on the program once again. And everyone, of course, you can go to WrestleSpective.com. The podcasts are posted there. Also have blog entries with mostly videos and photos related to the podcast. We get into some other things as well. Check us out. WrestleSpective is on iTunes as well. We're also on Stitcher now if you prefer the streaming audio on your iPhone or whatever you'd like to do. So lots of ways to listen to us. Just please check us out and tell your friends about us. We always like to spread the word on what we're doing. The main event podcasts, going through all the main events of the past and pay-per-view main events and checking those out. We're also talking about wrestling movies recently. So always appreciate people checking us out and any feedback we can get. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll be back again another time.